Welcome to Choosing Better, conversations about wacky ideas, economics, and the art of living well. It's been a while. Good to be back.
Been a few weeks. Listeners, if you are used to our regular Friday releases, we apologize for missing a Friday. We had a bank of three record episodes, and we exhausted the bank.
It's been, you know what? You got to expect the unexpected. There's always something in this line of work. You took a little trip out of the range of internet. And so did we in Mexico City. I had no internet reception, no cell phone, and barely any internet reception. It was kind of surprising.
Well, that's wild. Mine was expected. Mine was deliberately like Scottish borders, which, by the way, any listener who's considering going to Scotland, I never in my wildest dreams would have thought going south from Edinburgh would have been just as beautiful as going north in the Highlands. Oh, unbelievable.
Just beautiful country. Sounds amazing.
Beautiful country. Beautiful country. It was good. And then while we were there, we had no internet, but Enoch, I did walk into a room and I caught my youngest two sons with our iPad podcasting.
Following daddy's footsteps.
My 6-year-old and my 9-year-old were podcasting and I listened to their podcast. Well, they had music and their music was a variant of ours. So they record themselves singing. Bum, 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 ba-dum.
Like that. Wow, that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Pretty good. Yeah. And then they were just talking about
acapella music to intro.
Yeah. One of their episodes is on their favorite stuffed animals and why.
Nice.
It's great. I loved it.
I'd want to know, like, what do kids want?
Should we?
It's our daughter's birthday coming up. I got to know. What do 9-year-olds want?
Maybe we can start a bonus feed for paying subscribers. Hey, one quarter per week, and you get bonus feed of a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old.
That's what everybody's waiting for.
Unfiltered. Oh, they're begging for it. Well, Enoch, I have some trivia for you.
All right, let's get going. Right.
Here we go. So today's episode is on free speech, as the title suggests. So my first question for you is, which Western democracy consistently has the lowest scores over the last couple of years, has the lowest scores for free speech measurements?
All right. Is it on the Iberian Peninsula?
No, it's not. It's not on the Iberian Peninsula. That's an amazing question. Is it one of these two countries?
Yeah. I know. If you're playing Guess Who, you want to get the most median choice, but I just eliminate very little.
No, it's a very non-Enoch strategic play.
Yeah. Unstrategic. All right. Is it in Europe?
All right. It is in Europe.
It's in Europe?
It is in Europe. Yeah. And actually, and also, I mean, this is key.
Does it matter where we cut the scores? High democracy scores.
Yeah, because it's a full-fledged democracy. I mean, it clearly is in the category of democracy. There's a few, for example, European democracies that, as of a couple of years ago, their democracy, like Hungary and Poland, some people would say they're hybrid or flawed democracies. Mm-hmm. This one is not that low.
I see. So it's clearly democracy, but low in the freedom. Yep. Freedom of speech or just – what was it? Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. Yep. Which includes journalism, like reporting. Yeah.
Is it France?
It's not France.
Is it a commonly cited country?
I mean, I don't know what that means, but yes. I mean, do people know it in their head?
Yeah. Would you think of it right away?
Maybe after this category.
I don't even know. I have no idea. Norway?
The United Kingdom. There you go.
It's the UK.
Where I am. It's the UK. It's the UK. Yes.
Wow, I would not have
Because guessed. Of their recent so, legislation. I know.
It's the legislation that... But you said for the last several years.
I'm sorry. I said several years. I don't know. Like, you know, 3 or 4. Sorry, okay. You thought like decades. I apologize. I didn't mean to frame you.
No, that's all right. You don't need to apologize. I would not have guessed the UK.
All right. By the way, when it comes to like subjective ways of thinking about places, my wife and I had this whole long conversation. What's the most recognizable city in the world? And I was like, I don't know how to do this. And she's like, well, Google it. And I said, Google can tell us.
It might be a reasonable way of choosing. Most cited might be most recognizable.
That's the question. If the most Googled city is most recognizable, because I said Paris, I thought Paris was my go-to. And she said, no, it's probably Jerusalem. I said, I don't know. If you're outside the Abrahamic faith traditions, I'm not sure Jerusalem. And we got this whole discussion about whether or not someone from East Asia from a Confucius Buddhist background would think of Jerusalem. Anyway, I'm meandering.
Well, and you have a technological bias if you're using Google, right? Like,
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of things going on there. All right, next question. Ready? The UK does not have a constitution, which most democracies do. The UK is one of a few countries that do not have a constitution. However, what serves to protect? Well, what is the bedrock of basic rights and basic freedoms for UK citizens? So a UK citizen says, I think my basic freedoms are right now under attack.
There's some institution that they can go to.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is.
Okay, so just full disclosure, Tim taught history at the high school level. I was like, if there's any subject that I am terrible in, it is history, which is to my shame. It is like the core. Oh. It is the core discipline in Mexico.
But for the listeners, though, they've already realized that Enoch Hill is master of most trades. So
master of none, I think that's how the saying goes.
No, but for you, though, it's actually master of most trades. As I said, yeah, you are definitely, you're beyond a jack. So your low knowledge of history your low knowledge of history might be higher than the median individual's knowledge of history.
I just want to embarrass myself.
Oh, it's fine. I don't think most Americans know the answer to this. Actually, it's funny. Almost everyone in Britain I talk to.
Is it a document or is it an institution?
It's both. There's a document, but you can also go to the institution that oversees the document.
Is it governmental that interprets the document?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Here's a hint, though. It's intergovernmental. And so the U.S. does not have this at all. This is very, very un-American. It's the European Human Rights Convention, which is not part of the European Union. So the European Human Rights Convention was written in 1950, signed in 1953, and has its own
recent
court system. Yeah, it has its own court system, and most countries in Europe are signatories to it. And so, for example, we're going to talk in a moment, listeners, about Scotland, specifically their hate crime law legislation that was enacted April 1st. So only 2 weeks before this recording was the law put in force. Many of my coworkers, and I guess colleagues, I'd say not coworkers, but colleagues and peers here in Scotland have said, we are confident that this law will actually be overturned. It'll take some time. It has to go to the Human Rights. It has to go to the European Human Rights Convention. And once it goes there, we're confident that they will overturn it because it violates articles.
There was no institution that protected individual rights officially in
UK? You had common law. So just in the United States, most of our individual cases are decided by common law, not constitution framework. But it'd be decided by, you go to court and you go to
it's like collective decision making over a long period of time.
Precedent. There's constant precedent. But because there's no constitution, that doesn't mean Parliament in Westminster, at least, so in London, is by definition constitutional. So they could, in theory, pass any legislation they want that even upends precedent, which is why the House of Lords serves a very important role of crying out the moral failure of legislation. So, for example, right now in the United Kingdom, the current government, it's not Scotland, but the whole United Kingdom, the current government has a pretty unusual policy for asylum seekers. They're paying Rwanda to take UK asylees. So in the UK, when an asylee shows up to the United Kingdom, the current government has proposed, it's called the Rwanda proposal, to pay Rwanda to take the asylum seekers from the United Kingdom.
Okay.
This is very unusual for democracy. It's so unusual that many people would say it's downright non-democratic. It's not part of a free society. So but the problem, though, is the House of Commons, which is Parliament, can do whatever they want to do. There's no basic human
There's no
right
backup.
There's no right. backup. So the House of Lords, their job is to do, I'm putting quotes here, consultation on legislation. So for example, when my family and I were visiting the House of Lords, as one does, and we sat in the visitor gallery, you could see particular lords. Once again, this is in quotes. Not all of them are actually lords. But almost all of them have a jurisprudence background. So they all have like very deep knowledge of the law. They were giving very formal speeches about how terrible the government is because of what they're doing, how completely out of step they are. And the whole goal, therefore, is to basically shame and to normatively guide behavior, which actually broadly works by doing that.
Wow.
Like,
So there's no like veto power. It's only through shaming power.
Yeah, it's normative. Yeah, all they can do is just cry out and say this is.
Now, do
so
their speeches
utterly
like influence popular opinion?
Oh yeah, I mean, like, for example, like my our family.
So there is a somewhat.
Well, yeah, I mean, when we attended House of Lords, we were only there for like maybe 20 minutes to watch. And one of the lords was giving the most like amazing speech. I mean, just so articulate. It was incredible. And then it was about the Rwanda policy. We just happened to show up for that. And then the very next day, the number one article, I think in the Guardian, was quotes from his speech that we listened to.
Wow.
Like that was like, just because, I mean, basically he's making fun of the government and saying, you know, just because you call a cat a dog doesn't make it so. You can say it's lawful, you can say it's legal and normative, but it's not.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow, that is fascinating. Thanks for the political science lesson.
There we go.
Like, yeah. This is like free class, free education.
But this does mean, though, when it comes to a law being passed that, for example, says you cannot freely express yourself, this will be triggered. This will definitely show up to the European Human Rights Court for sure, because of the ceilings of the issue.
Who adjudicates the European Human Rights Court?
There's justices from different countries that form a panel.
But this is the UK's primary like institution to protect its like within its countries.
Effectively, it is a governing intergovernmental association that supersedes UK law. If the UK wants to remain a party to it, if the UK, I mean, there's no enforcement mechanism. I mean, if the European Human Rights Convention Court decides, we think your law is terrible, and the UK says we want to do it anyway, they can just ignore it. But they're out of step with the European Human Rights Convention, and
so
with
the ultimate authority, like the ultimate backup, would be the decision of the House of Commons. Like that's the ultimate decision maker.
In Scotland, so this is really confusing because Scotland has their own parliament, but the Westminster London Parliament could always override Scotland's parliament. So Scotland's parliament passed the hate crime law. Westminster has done nothing yet. That's London. If they want to, they can step in and say, that's ridiculous. We're overriding that because those are UK citizens. Scottish citizens are also UK citizens. We're overriding that. But the European
Scotland's
Rights Court,
entire governance depends on the favor of Westminster.
That's a little bit of a simple statement, but sort of.
You're right. Yeah. I mean, I guess
there's already agreements they already have about devolved power. So, for example, like national healthcare or NHS is run the moment you cross a Scottish border, you go to an NHS Scotland doctor and an NHS Scotland hospital. They have complete autonomy on their NHS system, but they do not have any autonomy whatsoever on things like foreign trade or foreign policy.
But their autonomy exists only as long as it pleases the House of Commons.
Yes, I mean, Westminster could take it away, although that'd be really unpopular, and that would lead to it itself rejecting precedent on
populism. I mean, as long as it's popular.
And the Scottish Parliament is, well, the Scottish Parliament was reconvened. So the Acts of Union, I think in like the 1700s, that removed Scottish independence and formed one big country. But then only like 25 years ago did Scotland get their parliament back. So it's relatively new. Anyway, we're getting lost on the weeds.
This is so fun.
Arrangements.
I am loving this. But I don't know if everybody is loving it. So maybe we should go to free speech.
Well, this episode was for us to have a conversation more around U.S. law and U.S. examples, because Enoch, that's our shared framework, our shared context, and probably that of most of our listeners.
I actually thought we were going to be talking about the Scottish.
Oh,
but that's perfect. Great. We should talk about the U.S. We should talk about the U.S.
We could do it both, though. We could do it both. Well, the nice thing about the Scottish example is I find at least that people are much more open to talk about the issue in its true holistic sense when it's not their context.
It's a little removed. Not too personal.
Yeah, if you're more removed, I think people are much more neutral on it. And they're like, well,
property rights on a star.
Yes. Property rights on a star. Way to do a throwback. Thank you. Thank you.
Our loyal listeners can smile.
Yes. All right. Last one and a half for you with this one. I have one more trivia. It's going to shift beautifully to the United States.
All right. Okay, ready? This has been embarrassing.
Can a public employee, meaning a person is employed by the government.
Yes, no questions left.
Local, state, federal. Can a public employee in the United States block a critic from his or her social media profile? In other words, if I'm a government employee, can I block a critic from my social media profile, my Twitter feed or X?
I'm going to guess no, but I don't know for sure.
It's maybe.
I mean, it's no. Oh,
it's currently in the courts. It's currently in the courts.
Oh, wow.
Well, I mean, it made a big news. Well, yeah.
As an individual, it seems like you should, but as a pub, in your position as public official, it seems like No. Right?
Yes. So, well, sorry, I didn't say yes, I disagree with you, but so this is initially a case with when President Trump, is when he's in office from 2016 to 2020, he blocked people from his Twitter account who are critiquing
him. I see. Okay.
And the question was, can he do that? Because is that silencing free speech that they can't express themselves on his Twitter account? But he left office. So it was never actually, there's no standing anymore. There is a case, though, with a Port Huron, Michigan city manager that lists their job on their Facebook profile, and they blocked critics from talking about the city management of Port Huron, Michigan. And one of the critics said, hey, that's my free speech rights, bro. My free speech rights. I had the right to express how bad of a city manager you are. The lower courts, so, and by the way, President Biden's administration has publicly voiced their support with the city manager.
Okay.
But the many different free speech advocacy groups have expressed their support of the plaintiffs. And this is so far has only gone to lower courts, and lower courts so far have ruled with the city employee and said, no, okay, you are a private individual. You may block. But the Supreme Court has just given guidance and said, we want the lower courts to revisit these.
Hmm.
I know.
I mean, it seems like there should be a distinction between your life as an individual and your life as a public official.
Yes.
And so I think the clarification needs to come in what makes an account, like if you conduct public business or you make public statements using your authority as a public official, probably can't. If I were to have to rule, my own decision would be that would be the distinguishing point. Like if you made statements that leveraged your position, or if you officially titled your account in some way that linked to your official position.
This is so fascinating because I feel like many of our colleagues in higher education, I don't mean Wheaton College, I mean broadly academic colleagues, they would disagree with you.
Okay.
Because they would say their academic freedom, which those don't know, academic freedom is effectively a free speech norm that's applied, so normally applied to professors to say they have the right to express themselves in their full sense with their research, because that way they can pursue truth, even if the truth is offensive. But many of our colleagues, I'd say, would view their social media to fall under academic freedom. Which is in a way, I think, implicitly saying there is not a separation between private versus public work.
Oh, I don't think I agree with you what you're saying.
Like, really? Go ahead, please.
I mean, I think that we're both trying to embody a different person's like argumentative system.
Well, it's because you and I don't really have active. I mean, I don't have social media because I don't trust myself with it. just by the way, not because I'm afraid of a rule. I'm afraid of just like hurting friendships. That's sure. My whole thing.
Yeah.
But I actually don't agree with this line. I think that people's social media, by and large, is not covered by academic freedom, because I think that academic freedom normatively is supposed to protect research and scholarship. And I think that a person shooting off a tweet at 2 a.m. when they can't sleep is not the same thing as someone conducting a report or a scholarly paper on a very contentious issue.
Oh, I mean, I agree with you there. I think we're talking, but the original example was in the opposite direction, was can you block individuals from viewing your public
That's
statements?
That's right. You're right.
So yeah. it's almost like if the hypothetical colleague were to declare their Facebook channel as an outlet for their professional work, they're almost trying to declare it as something more than just their private channel. Right? Like if they're trying to say it's protected under their academic freedoms, they're trying to say that it is explicitly linked to their role, not their individual.
Actually, I think they might say it's just their identity.
Oh, like they're just one person that is both in the job and out of the job.
That's right. That's right. Mm. Which actually is fascinating because on that logic, though, that gets really difficult, because if a city manager is very clearly expressing their identity as a public employee on their Facebook account, should therefore they not be allowed to block public criticism of their city management job?
Yeah, The details are always tricky because it seems
that's
like you
always,
can say,
that's
like,
always
this
always
is my
court
job.
Cases are. All the court cases are like really muddy and like, yeah, exactly. They're corner cases.
Life is beautiful and messy.
Okay. So Enoch, I have a personal question for you. So yep. United States, I think most people would consider the United States to have the strongest free speech rights of any country. I can't think of one that has stronger free speech rights. Maybe one exists, but off the top of my head, I can't think of one. I would say it's probably the bedrock of our freedoms. We have many freedoms espoused in the Constitution, but when these freedoms are kind of coming at each other, because oftentimes the really difficult cases are like two freedoms converging, oftentimes it seems to me that freedom of speech wins out frequently. And I know mm-hmm. that my own experience being abroad, people think that we're a bit mad about a free speech law, right? So they go, you Americans, you let people say anything. Like, no wonder you're so troubled. No wonder you have such horrible politics. People can just run around and say what they want. So my question for you, Enoch, is what do you think about American free speech rights?
Well,
are you proud of this legacy?
In thinking about this topic, I was thinking, okay, well, why do we have free speech? What does it protect and what is it there for? And then what is the trade-off? What do we lose by having it and what do we gain by having it? And I think there's like maybe a spectrum from stability and staying consistent with what you currently believe and allowing for change. And anytime you make a discovery, it's something that was not known before. By definition, it's something new. And so it is never going to be the majority opinion when it is discovered. Like, is the earth flat, or are we the center of the universe? I heard a great example this morning, like the Wright brothers. There was broad consensus that anything like that human beings could not fly scientifically. Like, that was the consensus. The Wright brothers proved everyone wrong by doing it. And there's something similar in thought. Like, at one point in time, if we view the past from the present, we view certain ways of thinking that were dominant as completely wrongheaded right now. But at some point, for us to get from there to here, there had to be a first person or a first group of people who thought differently. And to ever allow that group to become the majority, there has to be some system which allows that to happen. And I think that is, unless you are so prideful as to think that we currently are at the epitome, the top of all moral and scientific and like understanding, and that there is no more future to discover or no more advancement to occur, I feel like you got to be at least in favor of some amount of free speech.
Your argument
is kind of like risk averse versus risk. Go ahead.
Okay, you your argument, though, is about like progressing knowledge.
Progressing, yeah, and truth, and the idea that we don't actually know, we don't know. And if you take that premise.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be, that's a great argument, I think, from an academic perspective about why academics should be allowed to say things that are offensive at times, that are immoral even. I mean, your example of Copernicus, your example of the sun, it can be a little bit challenging when you're violating a theological tenet about what is the center of the universe, right? Right. I mean,
whether all people are equal, or whether you should, whether someone should be able to own slaves, or all of these things are changes in thought that are in the minority position at one point in time.
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting too, because like when we're in the middle of those things kind of shifting, we feel really uncomfortable about the free speech. So yours though is still about a sense of a knowledge and a sense of like learning. But I think you'd also talk about like the way the society is going, like which direction. So, for example, I've been reading a book lately about eugenics, and I'm not sure your argument there applies quite fully, Enoch, about like learning. Maybe it does. But it might be also about like what society do you want? Do you want society to go into a direction in which you're screening out particular traits? Or do you want society to go in a direction in which it's all natural born, and therefore all traits are there? In other words, like those who are listening, go ahead.
I disagree. I think that either you start with the premise that some people hold the like either, and you can use it as some people. You can use it like as a committee or a board, or you can use it as the majority, or you can use it as the supreme dictator ruler, whatever it is, that some small party or large party has like the corner on the way things ought to be or should be.
Yeah, I agree with that part. Yeah, because I think that's what I want to get you toward. I want to get toward like normative as well, not just pure like knowledge as far as like what is true objectively, but also
what
is
subjectively
good.
Should be, ought to be.
That's right.
No, I agree with you. And then the other, the what free speech allows is it allows us to say, like, none of us has a perfect understanding on any specific topic. At best, we can have like probabilistic understanding, you know? And the only hope that we have is that on average, that there's some wisdom to crowds, like that on average, people, if exposed to enough ideas, will be more likely to choose better ones and worse ones. And we can be like mostly bad. We can not mostly bad at it. We can be like barely good at it. We can be like 40% of people are going to just choose the blatantly dumb, terrible idea. And just a couple more than half are going to choose, be likely to choose better versus worse. But if that's the case, and you allow freedom of speech and you allow persuasion and you allow like the confrontation of different ideas, then it doesn't have to be like one person doesn't have to be expert at anything. Like I can be good at math or economics and pretty bad at history. And, yeah. And in the domains that I'm better at, like maybe I'll try to exert more effort or at persuading other people. And in the areas where I know I'm worse at or know that I'm less informed in, I'll be like more apt to listen or try to understand or learn more. And if I'm exposed to more ideas, hopefully I'm more likely to choose better ones than worse ones. But if I'm wrong and everyone disagrees with me, free speech allows that, you know, allows some chance of the emergence of better ideas rather than worse ones.
Is there any way in which lying can improve society? I'm asking this because I want to get at the difference between legal interpretation or law versus like what you're doing right now. You're making a philosophical argument about the merits of free speech, which is actually what I want to do as well. But
we are you doing like defamation?
Well, we live in a legal context, and so most of the United States are free speech precedent, and our rules are interpretations of law, not what is good. Right? You know, the courts don't rule necessarily like, oh, that's a good use of speech. Like that's the way speech is meant to be. You're doing what's the purpose of speech? What is it getting you toward? But the courts oftentimes are ruling on just what's the law. So, for example, there was a 2012.
Itself, if you go back one level, the law must have been developed with some idea of the good.
That's right. But in the United States, for example, our First Amendment rights is about Congress shall make no law that infringes free speech. And so that's basically been interpreted as all levels of government, not just Congress. We have earlier precedent that includes local law, that includes state law, and also includes federal law. But for example, there's a Supreme Court case that upheld an individual's right to lie because there was a congressional law passed. I can't remember what it's called. Something about the Americans with Valor Act, something like that, some kind of very great name, that said it was illegal to lie about receiving a military medal. You weren't allowed to do that. And the individual was prosecuted because he was lying that he was a Medal of Honor recipient. He kept saying he was. And so I'm guessing this congressional act was passed for him. Like, let's get him.
Stop doing it.
And the Supreme Court ruled, no, you can do that. Like, not philosophically, because the actual literal letter of the law, like the letter of the law, Congress shall make no law that infringes free expression, right? Free speech.
Was violated.
Violated, yeah, exactly. Congress made a law that said you're not allowed to lie. Now, they didn't, I mean, of course, with the larger interpretations, perjury still counts. You can't perjure yourself in court, for example. You can't lie under oath, under testimony. Mm-hmm. But philosophically, Enoch, is there any benefit to allowing people just to lie?
Well, I would say that it is very hard in many cases to know exactly what the truth is. And if you allow courts or other individuals to determine what is lying and what is not lying, you quickly get into murky areas. Like you could say like it to lie about the realities of gender or something, and you get into very contentious issues really quickly, and whoever holds the power to adjudicate basically holds the answer to questions that are not objective.
I'm glad you went there. I just hope you go there because I think that's what I want to get at. Is like once you determine that lying is bad, the example I just used, that's a pretty open and shut case of like, sir, you don't have a Medal of Honor.
Right.
It's like, at least I do. Like, no, you don't. Like, we looked at the log. No president ever gave you one. Like,
made a new medal, new medal category.
But you crushed it because that's the concern is that if we say lying is wrong, then you do have a higher court that determines what is appropriate. And as we just mentioned, so many of our contentious issues are contentious because the groups differ on what is true. So, for example, your example about gender, is gender part of innate sex or is gender identity something that arises socially? Does it arise internally. And many people have such strongly held beliefs, they're going to say, if you don't agree with me, then you are lying. Right? Mm-hmm. In other words, if we allow lying
both
to,
ways,
to be determined.
Both ways, in any direction.
Totally both ways. Yes, completely both ways. All right, so this is great. I love that we're discussing free speech in this context. Can I give you some thought experiments or some scenarios? I want your reactions on. Okay, all right, I have one for you.
Way better than trivia.
So we put it through. Here we go. These are just there's no right or wrong answer, but I'm going to let the fate of a country be in your hands. Okay.
All right. Great.
So
great.
Let us suppose that you are the U.S. president, Enoch.
Okay.
And well, let us suppose that. Yeah, you
I mean,
are. You have
a lot
to
lie.
Okay. You are lying. Okay. Not normatively, but legally, yes. Okay, so let's suppose that you are the U.S. president, and you internally really value democracy and the freedoms of the United States. You embody them. You love them. Okay.
Okay.
And you are thrilled because Algeria is having elections, and you're thrilled. You're like, all right, democracy is spreading. Democracy is moving to North Africa. We're so excited. But your CIA analysts come to you, and they say, sir, the leading party in the polls is an Islamic party, and they're running on a platform of Sharia law, and they're saying, vote for us. If you vote for us, the correct form of government will be in place, which does include no more elections, no more freedom of expression, no more freedom of belief. Okay? And they're polling really well. Let's say they're polling at 55%. And this is a parliamentary democracy. So if you get 55%, and if you get 48%, you're probably going to still control the parliament. Okay. So here's my question for you. If given the two options, would you rather override democratic process and limit that party's assembly rights, expression rights, or would you rather fulfill democratic processes, knowing full well that the democratic consequence will be completely eroded?
I mean, you got to go with the second. You cannot in good conscience, like, go with the first one and still believe in democracy, right? Like, I think that your avenue in a democratic, like, arena is to try to persuade. And that has to be the route. And if you don't persuade the majority, then you have to accept the, like,
The second was you don't let them run.
No, the second one was you do let them run, right?
Oh, sorry, you do let them run. I'm sorry. You're right. Yes. You're right. I confused myself. I was right. So the second one is you say I'm doing nothing to erode the process of democracy, by no full well that democracy will die in Algeria.
No, you don't know full well. You do everything you can. You do everything you can to try to persuade.
Okay. You don't know probably, but the party has told you, explicitly.
Okay, let's suppose 99.99. There's 99.99%. You will democracy will be ended if you do not actively intervene. If you do not undemocratically intervene. That's the situation, right?
Actually, the situation, this could easily result in the United States limiting one group's right to express themselves and then letting some centrist group win against popular will. This example is actually very relevant. I mean, look at, like, Hamas, for example. Hamas wins, and then that's it, right? No more elections, mm-hmm. right? In Gaza. And I think right now, a lot of people, actually, to be honest, it's funny. I love Enoch. You're like, this is easy. I mean, to me, I use this example to students, and I tell them, this is why I don't want to become president, because this is not easy. Yeah. I don't want to make either decision. I hate it.
No, but we know. Yeah, it's easy from my armchair position. Way easier from my armchair position. I will grant that.
Put yourself in the Oval Office, my friend. Put yourself in your own mind. I can't ignore. I'm with you.
You have all of Latin America's, like, historical examples of us, like, thinking we know which way to push the scale, and, like, resulting in, like, genocide in Guatemala. Like, I just feel that if you believe in democracy, you have to believe in democracy, right? Like, you can't believe in democracy by imposing your will on other people. Right?
All right. So, you know what? This is great. Let me now take it home. I have a second scenario, which is domestic.
Wait. No, I want to hear your take.
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, like, I used to be like, this is easy. It's process. John, I'm a big believer in free expression. As you said too, like, persuade. But also, what happens if you wind up having a society in which persuasion is outlawed? Like, there's only a single
party. Well,
then
it's not a democratic process. Then you didn't get democratic. Then you didn't actually get to.
I mean, if I'm reading the polls, I'm like, oh my gosh, elections are next week. and this party is pulling at 70%. Now, granted, I think actually in a foreign context, I leave it alone. I'm actually with you. In a foreign context, I say, like, you know what? Like, actually, it's somewhat democratic of me to let other countries choose and not be democratic.
Well, and you're basically like if we're getting back to free speech, the whole like premise or foundation is that you might be wrong. Like, we all might be wrong. None of us knows what is the, like, we have a very strong belief in what is a better or worse way to govern.
Yeah.
But if you're willing to say that, like, if you're willing to say I'm a believer in free speech, you're willing to say I might be wrong.
And also, we just before in this podcast, but if we aggregate up, even you and I don't believe in full uncensored speech across the board because I censor my children like crazy.
No. This is at the governmental level. Like, we're
that's
not.
Right.
I mean,
it's a governmental level. I'm saying
definitely in favor of limitation of free speech.
The Islamist government example is effectively almost like my family example aggregated up to the national level. I'm saying, like, hey, we're doing, like, in order for society to flourish, we're not going to let obscene things be said. We're not going to let things that are blasphemous said. Like, you decadent West, you let blasphemy be said in the streets. Like, you're insane. Your free speech rights are an idol upon themselves, which actually, quite frankly, is, I mean, I know a lot of people who do think that free speech is the most important thing in the entire world, even more important, for example, than like spiritual health. But I'm going to turn it now to a domestic example. Okay, so I was attending.
I was actually going to pose a domestic example. So you pose yours.
Okay, I'll go my first. Okay, so I was attending a protest. I mean, I walk by protests all the time in Edinburgh. Because I live right next to them. They go down the Royal Mile. And I love protest. It's funny. A lot of people who I'm like, some people I interact with who love free speech, they'll be like, oh, protesters, they need to get over it. And I'm like, I thought you liked free speech.
That's free speech.
Exactly. Protest is such a democratic thing. I'm like, let's go. But I was watching a protest. It was a big protest. It was marching. It was about the war in Gaza. And there's many groups in it. You know, a broad coalition. But one of the groups toward the back was the Communist Party. And I was like, oh man, there they are. The Communist Party. I don't mean socialist. I want this very clear for any listener. I do not mean socialist. I mean communist, the capital C. Right? Hammer and sickle, Communist Party. Which means they are running on a platform of no more party competition. Right? Vote for us. We're going to centralize this. We're centralizing the whole thing. No more inter-party competition. Inter-party competition. I guess intro would still happen in theory, but no more inter-party competition. No more full expression. No more freedoms. We have other freedoms. We have the freedom of work, freedom of job. Like, everyone is employed, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I watched them. I thought to myself, man, you're all freely using the democratic rights of this country to try to get yourselves in power to erode them,
to remove them all. That was exactly the case, the thought experience, not with Communist Party, but yeah.
All right, so domestically, Enoch, would you say, for example, a person has limited free speech rights if they do not recognize free speech?
I mean, like, if they're running, so if they, through free speech, acquire the political power to eliminate free speech,
or on the process,
can the belief in free speech?
Yeah, because right now it's not very scary. Because I mean, for example, in Scotland, it's like, I think probably less than 1% of Scottish voters support the Communist Party. I mean, they're effectively nothing. But like, what suppose it's 50%? Would you say case? Let's say the United States, for example, if a party was rising in popularity to 30 or 40%, and they had an explicit agenda saying speech is over, like, you know, if you vote for us, when we're in charge, It's done. Like, the Constitution's over. Vote for us. Put us in power. Do you think that they should have less rights?
Don't you have? No, I mean, I think that that's what you have to say. I think you still have to keep. It would be a lot harder, and maybe it would be harder, but only because it's more close to home. Like, it affects you more directly. But if you believe in the foreign affairs case, can you undemocratically? Like, aren't you just advancing the same concept if you undemocratically censure them?
I think so. I think you are. I lean toward you because my fear too is who's the adjudicator of all these things. But I want to turn it a little bit now to practical, like, very recent history. I think this is why, though, many people were just instinctively and emotionally angered at the December 2023 university president's congressional hearing. So do you remember, like, when the MIT and Harvard yes. and Penn presidents. Yep.
Yep.
We're in front of the committee meeting and they're defending under free speech law, as we are right now. Right now, Enoch, you and I are doing right now, defending free speech law that, you know, yeah, some of our students say really horrible things. As a matter of fact, they say terrible things, but context matters. Actually, if you ignore the context stuff, that made a lot of people mad. But like, I think the reason why some people are really mad is because you're like, can they get a lot of people like, you're being hypocrites. You've been hypocrites for the last right. I think 10 plus years. Yeah, exactly. Yes. The last 10 plus years, your institutions have been leading the foreground on things like rhetoric is violence. And you've been censoring student groups. You've been censoring professors and you've been censoring guest speakers. I mean, for sure, that's the number one. Like, certain guest speakers are not allowed on campus because what they say is hurtful, harmful, or even violent. And now when it comes to actual violent rhetoric that is borderline actually violent toward particular groups of Jewish students and Jewish individuals, that now you're saying free speech rights. I think that's what actually made people angry.
I think it was the inconsistency.
Yeah. So I think you and I are being more consistent, but I think the Harvard, Penn, and MIT example just really angered a lot of Americans because of that being caught very naked with leading the agenda on hurtful and harmful right. rhetoric should be silenced. All of a sudden saying free speech.
Specific kinds of hurtful and harmful rhetoric that I'm in favor of or against should be silenced or allowed.
Yes. Which I think also demonstrates some of the, I hope at least, maybe why free speech is good, because it does protect you. And when you get caught in these ways going both directions, you can say, hey, I'm just trying to make it open for everybody else.
Well, let's switch, because you switched the topic slightly. So before we were at the government's ability to limit free speech, and now we're at a private institution's, private or semi, it depends, you know, we got public universities and private universities, but it's smaller, like non-governmental institutions' ability to limit free speech. What's your stance at that level?
Well, I do think that, if I teach politics at Wheaton College, many freshmen in particular come in with the confusion about free speech. You know, they're like, oh, free speech is under attack in the United States. I say, no, not really. I'm like, yes, it is. Look, they're getting canceled. People are getting fired. They're getting blocked on Twitter. I'm like, those are all private channels. That's different. I was like, I said, like, your free speech rights are extremely strong legally in the United States. I said, you know, for example, at Wheaton College, we work at a private religious institution which has its own free speech rights, which do not allow anything to be said on its campus. Like, I mean, by anything, I mean like all things. Like, you know, they limit what can be said. So, for example, I brought some of my kids as an example. When a protester, and I said, you know, I think one day my kids saw some guy standing near campus. The base is like, y'all going to hell. I don't know. You know, talking about those kind of guys who come to campus once in a while. They're like, you're all terrible Christians. You're all going to go to hell. I said, that gentleman has the free speech rights to hold that sign on a public sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
But he does not have the free speech rights.
Can't cross onto the lawn. Blasted lawn, nope.
Exactly. He cannot go to the private sidewalks on the quad. Now, if it was University of North Carolina, he could. At University of North Carolina, it's a public institution. He can go on any sidewalk he wants. But at Wheaton College, it's a private institution. The campus safety will hopefully very politely and very kindly escort him back to the public sidewalk.
Public sidewalk.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So
what's your stance? I mean, I have an opinion, but I want to hear your opinion first on, can Harvard do that?
I think Harvard absolutely can limit free speech. Actually, honestly, I'm in defender of Harvard's free speech rights probably more so than your average American. I mean, I'll even go further. I think when Harvard lost
non-free speech rights, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or free speech rights? No, they have the free speech rights to limit speech on their own campus. It's like for example, me in my home, my free speech rights mean if you come to my house, Enoch, and you say, I'm going to start saying blasphemous things against Christianity, I'll say, not here, sir. Not here. Like, I'm exercising my free speech rights about what's said in my house. And you're not going to say that here. Like, please leave now. If you say I refuse to leave, I say I'm going to call the police for trespassing.
And you can have inconsistent ones. I mean, like, you can have inconsistent ones as a house, and you bear certain benefits and consequences to that. Like, you probably allow certain types of statements that wouldn't be allowed in other households, and you don't allow other statements that would be – I don't know what I'm saying. Well, anyways, you can inconsistently apply limits to free speech. Like, you can say certain.
Yes, I can be utterly, utterly consistent. So actually, for example, Harvard lost in a very nuanced way their affirmative action case a couple years ago because they're discriminating against Asian Americans in particular and white Americans in their selection process. I'm almost right. Everyone's angered by it because defenders of affirmative action wanted more affirmative action. If you were opposed to it, wanted a full blasting of Harvard. And I think that's a really weird spot saying, well, they're private institution. And I'd be like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, it's their free speech rights to say who and who can't come to their campus. I don't really
by it being exposed, they are bearing the market, you know, feedback.
That's right. Exactly.
Like, I kind of actually think the correct thing happened at the congressional hearing was like Harvard and other institutions' inconsistent application of free speech laws were exposed. And now individuals can decide how much they're okay with that or not okay with that.
That's
it
right.
does seem pretty inconsistently applied.
That's right.
But there's going to be a response. And the response is
absolutely
largely, as far as we can tell, unfavorable. And Harvard can choose to continue to very inconsistently apply
yes.
free speech ideas.
You and I are definitely defenders of the marketplace and individual actions. And you're right. Harvard being exposed nationally and globally as being a place that is pursuing socialized versions of truth more so than academic prestige will limit and probably reduce the greatest thing Harvard has, which is a reputation. That is their number one
asset. And that is the whole idea of free speech, is that, like, hopefully over time, the ideas that are true as defined by the best interpretation of the broadest ranges of people will, like, emerge at the top. And so like, if Harvard's view of limiting free speech inconsistently is actually, like, viewed as correct and the right way to, like, advance humanity's general flourishing, then it'll probably receive, like, benefit from its exposure. But it seems like that is not the case. It seems the opposite was the case, that was broadly condemned. And so now institutions that you were mentioning earlier before we went on air that conversations on civil liberties or on civil discourse have become very, very popular through this fellow at Duke.
Yes, they're very, very popular. That's right. Yeah. Because of what's happening right now in society. Yes.
Exactly. And so that's a response. Yep. That is, like, the whole way that free speech works, is that some people advocate ideas that may or may not be popular. Like this idea of even social justice, like the ideas of the ways that social justice have been applied have been on the rise. At one point they were in the minority. They've moved towards either majority or at least popular among college universities. And now there's, like, a different idea or set of concepts that are being proposed, and, like, this is how free speech works. It's like there's going to be different ideas that collect momentum and gain collective approval or disapproval, and I mean, that's how it works, right? Like, so
that's
actually
right.
I think what we're seeing with the elite college congressional testimony as being how that's the whole idea of how free speech is supposed to work.
Yeah. So I have to, we have to limit our time here really quickly. So I'm going to try to land the plane, but I'm going to.
Please do.
But there's so much more to talk about, because honestly, one of the big things I want to talk about was the United Kingdom and juxtaposition. So I'm going to bring up just a little bit. We have a couple minutes. That's it.
Tease us, Tim.
Yeah, tease us. I'm going to bring up a little bit. So the United Kingdom has done a couple things. Nationwide, it's currently being debated to create so-called buffer zones around medical clinic access areas to abortion services. So the NHS, which is a national healthcare service, UK has abortion, and there's discussions about creating a 500 meter wide, or the number varies, zone in which people are not allowed to protest or even silently pray in that area because of intimidation to individuals who want to have abortion services. Now, obviously, that would not fly to the United States because that would include public sidewalks. It's a mm-hmm. fascinating thing. And most people and in the UK, by and large, a lot of the public says, like, well, this is a reasonable law. Like, women shouldn't feel intimidated when they go into an abortion clinic. And actually praying, and particularly the praying things, first off, you already can't protest. So the praying thing, a lot of people are saying, well, is the prayer effectiveness, does it vary if you're 600 meters away versus 200 meters away? Is that how God works? Which personally, I find that to be a problematic way of arguing. But that's one. And the other one, this passed in Scotland only, not UK-wide. As I said earlier, as of April 1st, in Scotland, it is illegal now to do hate speech. So if you say something that's hateful toward a particular group that's identified, gender, disability, religion, race, age, for example, you could be reported to police by a third party or a direct party for a hate crime incident. And you could face criminal prosecution. This has been a huge issue in Scotland. We have J.K. Rowling, for example. She's not Scottish, but in the UK, she's still tweeting and saying this particular person, so she's identifying. So this is key too, because she's actually really buying the law, because she's saying this particular person is not a woman. Because it's one thing to say, I don't agree with this overall idea. That's actually not part of the hate crime law. If you're saying particular people, or you're saying I'm going to be hurtful to this person, you're violating it. What's fascinating, though, is she's normatively challenging this, and she's forcing the Scottish government to actually make statements to back down off her. So she's used her own platform, for example, to say if any woman is saying a particular biological man is not a woman, and you wind up getting prosecution, just tell me what you said, and I'll tweet it out because I think it might have power. It's a fascinating example about, like, at least if I read the law, I think J.K. Rowling is actually violating the law, but yet the legal authorities are choosing not to prosecute her because they know that it's such a contentious thing to prosecute her in general. But this is a fascinating law, and I think that's actually the spirit of the law. Like you and I, Enoch, I don't like offending people. I don't enjoy it. I don't. I like friends. I mean, some people do. Some people actually like being shocking. I don't. Like, I self-censor all the time. All the time. Like, actually, if I had a student and said, what you said, you know, Dr. Taylor, really hurt my feelings, I'd be like, really? Why? Like, let's talk about it. And so I think the actual, like, the idea of the law to reduce hurt, reduce harm, I'm not opposed to that. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's the exact same as outlawing lying, right? Like, outlawing hate is something that everyone can get behind based on their own understanding of what is hateful. The problem is that we all disagree pretty deeply on, like, what would constitute a hateful statement. And it's that interpretation where we get into major trouble. And because it's almost definitionally subjective, or it's up to interpretation, somebody has to interpret whether it crossed some sort of hate line.
Yep.
That's where we're going to get in trouble, because it's not objectively clear. We can't say that, like, well, this statement, I mean, we can't learn even what is hateful. And that idea then can't evolve past how the law has interpreted it in Scotland. Or maybe it can evolve, but it can only evolve based on, like, a select few people interpreting what is hate.
That's right. Actually, maybe an example of this. So in the United Kingdom, right now in Scotland, for example, you could argue it flirts with a hate crime law if you particularly said it is harmful for adolescent teenagers to go through puberty blockers, to undergo puberty blockers to delay puberty altogether. That's harmful to their long-term effects. Someone could say that's hurtful to me. That's really hurtful. And they might actually block that discussion. But actually, that is a fascinating discussion that you need research and medical evidence to verify yes or no, and even to nuance it, just psychological harm versus medical, like physical harm, how these things cut past each other. But if you limit the ability to even say that and have a discussion, then you wind up never moving in either direction, or you only move in one direction without any other type of pushback to it. And actually, out there right now, it's really interesting. Simultaneously, Scotland's passing a hate crime law, but out of Westminster, so that's down in London, the NHS has basically put forward a report, the England and Wales NHS, saying puberty blockers might actually be harmful if you do them for children. And so you're like, well, these things seem to be, like, you need full expression to be able to actually talk about, I guess, so-called best practices and what's best for children.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, yeah, this is my other side of the spectrum. There are times where religiously, we're kind of dogmatic about our understanding of interpretations of the Bible. It's not something that we view as wanting to evolve, like, as a Christian community, right? We're not like, hey, all these heresies, we should be, like, equally vetting. And so I think if you want to say, like, this is what is truth, and we feel like we have had it revealed to us by God, we don't need to improve upon it. That's where freedom of speech might be, like, as a potentially negative thing, because what free speech does is allows movement, right? So if currently Scotland has, like, the end all be all of an understanding of, like, moral interpretation of what is good and right, what is right, and they want to freeze that forever as it is and not evolve as a society, then there's, like, merit to this idea of outlawing what they understand currently as hate forever, or, you know, embodying it in officially in an institution.
Yeah. This is why I think though, like to sort of return back to the United States example, I like living in society, even though I know foreigners think we're bonkers. I like living in a society that has extreme free speech protections legally, but I can voluntarily join associations that affirm particular truths. For example, like at Wheaton College, we have a statement of faith that says like, this is what we believe. And if you don't believe this, then you don't really belong here. But it's a voluntary association. So you can actually effectively limit what's, as you said, you can affirm age old truths that you don't want to evolve. You know, for example, you say, no, like, this is actually a belief of the divinity of Jesus Christ. We don't want to evolve, quote unquote, evolve on that. We want to maintain that Jesus is God and Jesus is part of the God in the three persons, right? The Son. We want to affirm that and not, quote unquote, evolve. But yet live in a society that the government doesn't put me in jail or put my friend in jail if they don't agree with what I just said, right?
Yeah. All right. Totally agree.
There's a lot, by the way, there's a lot more I could say. Unfortunately, the clock is running out on me and I have to censor myself with my own timing here. This has been a good conversation on free speech. I think we could evolve this potentially or develop this more in a future episode. Who knows?
Oh, absolutely. Most of these topics, you know, you don't exhaust a lot of these topics, which is the great thing about them.
That's right. But Enoch, it's been a delight to see you again.
Always a delight. Good to see you.
All right. Choose better than what you say.
Take care. You too.